Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we've got two more series confirmed. The 2-7s are live, so we're going to talk through what Celtics Sixers look like in the East, what Blazers Spurs look like in the Western Conference. We then shift to a little bit of a hybrid preview. We have play-in action happening later tonight. If either of those teams win, what do they look like against the Thunder and the Pistons, respectively? And then we flow to the W side. We got more free agency news. We get into some free agency winners and losers as we get closer to training camp or preseason play. We're going to have fun today. We hope you rock with us. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Friday. How are you?
Feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce here. Knock it off if you're asking that anywhere else. But I would say I'm excited to talk basketball, ready to talk hoops. It's that time of year where sleep is optional, but hoops is mandatory. And we have some more things to talk about, Nikias. Let's hoop it up.
What a bar. Oh, my. Sleep is optional. Hoops are mandatory. We need that on a t-shirt. But let's get into some more playoff series, Steve. After play-in action earlier this week, we have the 2-7 series locked in. And so we naturally start with those series. Let's start out west with the San Antonio Spurs taking on the Portland Trail Blazers. The Blazers fresh off of a 4-point win over the Phoenix Suns to advance and ultimately secure this spot. 2-1 regular season series lead for the San Antonio Spurs, but the Blazers were missing players in all three matchups. And most notably, Victor Wembanyama did not play against the Portland Trail Blazers this season. Now, if you want to go back into the film for years prior, you can get some seeds. But this year, Wimby hasn't seen the Blazers. And ultimately, the Spurs have not seen the actually healthy version of the Portland Trail Blazers that we've gotten over the last few games. So I am just excited about the newness and the freshness of what this matchup is going to be. The Spurs dealing with, you know, familiar but new characters in the matchup. And the Portland Trail Blazers now having to solve the Victor Wembanyama problem on both ends of the floor for the first time all season. So I am naturally excited about that one, Steve. Actually, I want to kind of start with Wimby because I think he figuratively and literally looms the largest in this series with how the Spurs want to deploy him on both ends of the floor and how the Blazers ultimately want to deal with him. Like, where are you at with the Wimby of it all in this series?
Well, I mean, I think the number one thing about Spurs Blazers is this is just an old school type of series to a degree, because you have a team in Portland who has a defense that I don't know if they get enough credit for how good it is and how it can scale up in the playoffs with the type of defenders they have, having a Drew Holiday, having a healthier Jeremy Grant, having Matisse Thybulle, having Tumani Kamara, having Donovan Clingan. There are things they can do to kind of elevate their defense and poke at you. And the Spurs, as great as they are, I think there are question marks as far as, you know, I think people want to tap the playoff experience button. I don't know if that's the full gambit, but I think this is a team that's going to have to figure out, okay, how do we now shapeshift into solving something in one series to a degree? What can this team present to us in one series? So I think it's going to be a great test for what the Spurs have built. The issue is the Spurs have built this with a high level of confidence. And so if you're talking about Victor Wembanyama, he changes who they are on both ends of the floor. And so we've talked about kind of the, you know, you've mentioned the role gravity that he has. We've talked about his aggression as far as finding the right position, being able to get to the post up, get to the elbow, wanting to fight through contact. He just elevates them. And then defensively, his ability to just shapeshift and be like, actually, doesn't really matter where you're going to put me on the floor. I'm going to find my way to where I need to be on the block. I'm going to communicate the rotations. Our guards and wings are going to nail those rotations. They're going to pressure the ball. They're going to navigate screens. That kind of limits, in theory, Portland's cap, because if you're Portland, you want to be a high defensive effort team. We have people who can get buckets on the other end. We can present this to you. But if the Spurs are like, well, actually, we're going to defend you and your offensive ceiling is lower, we're taking away some of that defense. That's where the back and forth gets really fun to me as far as this series goes, because can Portland generate enough offense consistently against the Spurs defense with Wemby versus the Spurs being able to kind of open things up offensively and have that high level defense?
No, I think that's a great way to frame it, Steve. And I think starting with Wemby on defense, I kind of want to see how the Spurs want to deploy him. Because as you've talked and written about, and as we've both kind of talked about in general, they want to keep Wemby low on the floor. Let's see if we can work things around. The Blazers, at least overall this year, they have been a pretty low flare slash pin and screen team. And I think that plus some of the exchanges you may see on the weak side, let's stash a shooter in this corner so Wemby has tougher decisions to make. The Blazers are going to have to be super intentional about that kind of thing in a way that, at least from a volume perspective, they were not in the regular season matchups and in the regular season as a whole. I think they were 27 in combined flares and pin and screen set this year per Second Spectrum. So like, I'm fascinated to see how they work to move Victor Wembanyama around. And related to that, are you putting Wemby on Donovan Clingan? Are you putting Wemby on Tumani Kamara, who has now become not just a solid three-point shooter, but a solid three-point shooter that is willing to take 8, 9, 10, 12, 13 threes in a game now? Is he going to knock down enough shots to where Wemby at any point thinks, you know, maybe I have to think about how quickly I am rotating into the paint to take away some of these drives that the Blazers want to get to? So, like, that portion is fascinating to me.
Well, real quick, I'm glad you said the word intentional, because that becomes so important come playoff time, because you are coming in with a game plan, you're trying to execute something, and the other team may not cooperate. I think that, to me, has been the secret sauce of Victor Wembanyama's defensive season. We have seen teams try and say, hey, we're just going to put you in action. Doesn't always feel great. Hey, we're going to put your man on the wing. Okay, if you run pick and roll, I'm just going to take the roller and get back to where I was. The fact that he's able to identify what teams are trying to do, you know, hey, we're going to move your man in the corner around. Well, I'm just going to stay here and point to where the switches are. The fact that he's able to shapeshift in that manner is where it gets interesting. But I think Portland has some dynamic guard play as far as being able to have a Drew Holiday, a Scoot Henderson. Can they take advantage and attack the guards in separate places? Can they kind of leverage some of that to take some pressure off of what Wemby can bring to the table? And on the flip side, if you're the Spurs, we are a team that has 48 minutes of excellent and solid guard play. And so can we have that kind of aggression and keep our poise and make you defend in a different way? Because we're, I don't want to say random attack, but we're a consistent flow type team in the sense that you don't necessarily know which action is going to get you. We're going to keep things moving. So it's on Portland to get the Spurs into the mud. It's on the Spurs to just kind of be aggressive. And, okay, Devin Vassell, Julian Champagne, be ready to shoot. Harrison Barnes, Kelton Johnson, give us juice off the bench. All of our guards get downhill. We have to kind of have our total team effort to poke at things and hope that Portland gets into a scenario where it's pick and roll. We get the rotations we want. We close back out. Now make a play. Also, Victor Wembanyama is back there in case you do make a play. I think that's kind of the balance and the meat of this series.
No, I think that is fair. I think quickly sticking with the guards, De'Aaron Fox was fantastic against the Portland Trail Blazers this year. And so for all of the different options that the Blazers can toss at any of the Spurs, honestly, and I do have a broader question about, are you putting Clingan on Victor Wembanyama? Are you putting Tumani Kamara on Victor Wembanyama and having Donovan Clingan roam elsewhere? How often are we going to see Drew Holiday just taking Wemby? You know, and I don't think it's just going to be his assignment, but when we see spots where he does that, maybe in clutch situations, things like that. But they are going to absolutely have to contain the guards in this one. They cannot allow De'Aaron Fox to get comfortable. They can't let Dylan Harper get comfortable. They can't let Devin Vassell get comfortable, for that matter. So I'm fascinated to see like how that portion is going to work out. And I think to your mud point for Portland, a lot of that very early on, I think, is going to be determined by how they're going to cross match and how they're going to defend. If they do keep things more static, are you putting Tumani on De'Aaron Fox to try to take some of those away? Does that put more emphasis on Stephon Castle to be aggressive offensively? Like, what are the downstream effects of things like that? And then, as I was thinking about potential counters, if the Spurs are able to get more flow-based early on, how often do we see something that you brought up very early on in the year, Steve? How often do we see this weird, funky Portland Trailblazer zone that they can tap into when they have a big out there or when they do downsize? Frankly, tied to that, how often will the Blazers feel comfortable downsizing in this series is going to be something that I'm keeping an eye on as we head into this one. But I do think, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, the Blazers are, the healthy Blazers that is, are uniquely equipped to bring the Spurs in the mud in a way that other teams like non-OKC division and even the Thunder had their issues with San Antonio. They have the personnel to really muck things up for the Spurs. Like, again, I am curious to see what these zone reps are going to look like, especially as the Spurs have gotten better against zone as the year's gone on. But they didn't have fun against the Blazers this year when they went to it, particularly their January matchup. and zoom out all the way. Again, no Victor Wembanyama in the regular season matchups, but Spurs were a top five offense this year, Steve. They had like a 113 offensive rating against Portland this year. The bigger issue is that Portland couldn't score enough consistently enough to win those games. But like, we do have a sample of, if you're not shooting well enough, we can flood the paint. We can pressure you high on the floor. We can sprinkle in this zone and make you move the ball. And again, dare your shooters or non-shooters to knock down enough shots to take us out of it. Like, there are absolutely pathways here for the Blazers to bring the Spurs into the mud. And that's where, more broadly speaking, I just kind of wonder, with all of the process growth that we saw from the San Antonio Spurs this year, because the talent speaks for itself, but we have these flares to put you in early peril. We can invert our offense with off-ball screens or with pick and rolls. Wimby's getting doubled when we post him up on the wing. Let's move to the middle of the floor and see what you want to do with that there. How much of that is going to carry over, and are the results going to follow against a Portland defense that has this level of length, this level of activity, this amount of pressure that they can toss at you in this series? Like, I think this is a fun early test for the San Antonio Spurs overall.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, as we mentioned, this is a good test, but I think the Spurs' mindset has all season long has been to play a certain way. And the fact that their defense is so high level, it's hard to purely bank on we can keep them in the half court, we can keep them in the mud, because they get stops, they run, they go, they get into a flow, they play out of that naturally. And so once they get transition, they get a feel, they get a rhythm, and then they get to reset their defense, all of a sudden your hot start, if you're up 8-3, now becomes 12-8 Spurs. So they're not purely having to execute in the half court. And that was seen in the matchups in the regular season, even without Wimby. So now if Wimby's here, we have a different feel. So it's on Portland to be really, really tight offensively if they want to make this a series. They have to be really, really concise, really intentional. A team that really knows where they want to attack, the shots they want to take, controlling tempo to a degree as far as when we may be a little bit slower in theory, but we know exactly when we want to attack. That's their best case scenario. But if you're the Spurs, you have to trust our defensive activity. You have to trust the principles we've tried to play with offensively all year long. And then trust that we can get stops. And even if we get in the mud a little bit, eventually we'll get these stops, we'll run, we'll play, and we'll get back to what we do. I think that's where it becomes interesting for Portland, because can you keep them in a scenario where they're in the half court? That's going to require you to score the basketball at a high level and a controlled level. If you're San Antonio, eventually we can get these stops and we can get out and run, get some easy ones. And now you have to score against our set defense. And so I think that's where the battle gets interesting, because who does that? Could I imagine Portland doing that 1, 2, 3 games? Absolutely. Like, they could shape shift this series by having high offensive performances. You asked the question about, hey, how small do they want to go? They have bigs that are really impactful and clinging in Robert Williams. So, okay, do we want to take that away from our team? When we go small, are we doing it from a position of strength? If I'm San Antonio, we know what our guards do. We know what Luke Kornet does. We have Wimby. You have to deal with the wave that we create. So I think that's where both teams can present an issue to each other. Who's going to kind of put their foot down into the mud and say, nope, this is our series?
Understood. And this is where, as you mentioned at the top, this could have an old school feel. Like, both of these defenses are going to be, or have the potential to be, very unkind to these opposing offenses. And I'll just say, on the Portland offense front, before we eventually shift into X factors and things like that, item number one for Portland is, can Denny Avdia kind of shape this series with his drives, with his playmaking, and with the playmaking in general? Will Portland knock down enough threes to where the drives feel fruitful? Because going back through the tape, basic numbers first and foremost, 32-7-8 for Denny Avdia on pretty efficient splits, sans the free throw shooting, but he got to the line quite a bit there. And the San Antonio Spurs, as you get into like what those possessions look like, they, like many other teams, were very intentional about, hey, let's keep Denny Avdia on his left hand. We know he wants to get right. We know he is able to power through our defenders when they're backpedaling. We know he can rip through their arms. He can get to the free throw line, et cetera, et cetera. And the Spurs did a better job than most at making sure he isn't right-hand dominant. Like, it was a pretty even split in terms of what those drives looked like. 36 drives going to his left, 37 to his right. And in terms of the drives per 100 possessions, fifth lowest mark going right against any opponent this year. And it still didn't matter in spots. And so, as Stephon Castle, a guy that, as we did the awards thing yesterday, he's someone that I think should make all defense, I am keeping an eye on what the foul trouble may look like for Stephon Castle if some of the prep stuff for him early in possessions isn't great. if the Spurs, as they did during the regular season matchup, sprinkle in some of the high pressure or some of the high pickup points, Denny is strong enough to handle that. And if you get a screen at half court and now he can just get to his right hand, how much help do you want to send if you're the San Antonio Spurs defense? And to your point about intentionality, if this is a series where, okay, we are going to be more intentional about setting flare screens on the backside, setting pin ends on the backside, mix again who's behind Wimby if he's trying to stay low on the floor, there are some real opportunities to where Denny can kind of shape this series in his image as a downhill threat. And if Portland knocks down threes like we saw them do, particularly in that first half of that Phoenix game, that gives them a little bit more wiggle room to then set all of the things that they can do defensively. So I am curious to see what that part is going to look like for Portland.
I mean, I think you feel the impact of those drives later in games if you're Portland. I think this is where the Wimby factor becomes interesting because of his ability to deter the aggression towards getting towards the paint. And now it becomes, could I see, let me cook, wiggle, get in the paint, draw a foul, make a bucket.
Oh, no.
Get to my shot. Oh, I could see that. But Wimby being on left block, right block, near paint, stunt, does that take some of that away? And does that alter what could be your Uno reverse card to a degree if you're Portland? And that goes for Shaedon Sharpe, who I think is an aggressive driver and wouldn't be afraid. But does that alter him? Does that alter Scoot Henderson? Does that alter Drew Holiday as far as turning the corner? Or, you know, your favorite, is going to just take the step back three where you say, oh, my God, why did he shoot that? Oh, he made it. And then you don't talk about it for 3 minutes. So I think it's just on Portland to kind of find the ways to level up. But that's where not having a feel for Wimby. Because when the Spurs consistently have made offenses think, and you've seen, okay, we have an advantage. Ooh, I drive a closeout. Oh, he's right there. Okay, swing the pill. Like that's you can't really account for that if you haven't experienced it. And so that's why I feel like San Antonio has the tone early in this series.
Yeah, I love that. I will say, if you're in practice, Portland having Donovan Kling and having Robert Williams, like probably the closest thing in a practice setting that you can simulate the Wimby effect, having those kind of shot blockers. But to your point, it is just not the same still. So we'll see what the adjustment period is. So, Steve, who are your X factors in this series?
Who are your X factors? I'm kidding. I think for me, it's, I'm going to go with Portland off the wall. Like, Drew Holiday always gets a salute for me because of the ability to elevate offensively and the impact he can have defensively. You never know what Drew could do as far as matchup wise and cause the chaos. I'm going to go Matisse Thybulle. I think if he's able to kind of be someone who's able to get consistent minutes in the series, defend multiple positions, occasionally knock down shots, that elevates Portland because we have a lot more lineup versatility. For the Spurs, I'm going purely Julian Champagne because when he's having those nights where he's knocking down shots, they're timely, they're painful, and you haven't necessarily prepared for that. He's the type of player who could take your game plan, throw it over the top rope purely because not you. We're trying to take all this away and you continue to make shots. This is not ideal. So those are probably my X factors. What say you?
I think broadly speaking, I am just fascinated by the second units for both of these teams. And I think if you were trying to eke out if you're trying to describe a Portland case in which they extend the series to 6 or 7, or even if they pull up the upset, I think it's going to be contingent upon, one, making sure that the Wimby minutes are fine instead of dominant the way they have been. Like, it's a plus 16.8 net rating with Wimby on the floor this year. Can we get that to like plus 5, plus 6, to where we're kind of holding serve? And then when you mentioned Matisse Thybulle and some of the activity he can cause, or he brings on the defensive end in particular, but you bring Matisse Thybulle in, you have Shaedon Sharpe, you have a guy like Jeremy Grant, welcome to April basketball, by the way, Jeremy Grant, Robert Williams, who can muck things up defensively. Like, I feel like Portland's 4 off the bench on any given night can outplay the top, you know, the bench 4 for San Antonio. Or really anyone. Like, they match up that well on the high end. And so, like, I think the second unit swings when Wimby is off the floor, when Denny is off the floor, because both of them have 2 of the largest on-off swings in the league. That could swing games and ultimately swing this series. Nailing down for individual players on the X-Factor front, for me, I start with Shaedon Sharpe, funny enough. His shot making, his movement off the ball, his ability to hold up defensively in the series is going to be under the microscope for me. Because I think if you're looking at transition attacks, he's someone that can get going. The self-creation you are probably going to need from the perimeter, especially if Wemby is falling off the paint. I'm keeping an eye on what Shaden Sharpe looks like. This is what, two regular season games plus the play-in game that he's been back, so he's still easing into things. If he plays well, the Blazers have a higher ceiling. And it's Devin Vassell for me on the Spurs side. The three-point shooting is going to be important. With Donovan Klingon or Robert Williams being in these deep drops, hey, how many of these handoffs can I turn into pull-up shots? How many threes can I knock down? How often am I screening for Victor Wembanyama on those wide pin downs to get him going inside the paint? He's going to be a key piece in this one. Steve, who do you have winning the series?
Spurs in six. I think the Moda Center will. I think the Moda Center will rock. We will exercise some demons. Shout to Sean Elliott, but I think the Spurs win the series. What say you?
What a cut. I'm going to go Spurs in seven, actually. I think this goes the distance. I think this Portland defense is going to show up in a way that a lot of people aren't anticipating. And while they were not a good three-point shooting team this season, like, there is a level of variance there with how often they take them. I think we get a long one in this case. I think the physicality, the defense versatility gives them a high floor, and I think we get some fun shot-making in at least three of those games. I do think the Spurs ultimately win the series. But I'm a little high on what the healthy Blazers can look like in this kind of confined setting. But with that, we shift to the Eastern Conference. We have the Boston Celtics taking on the Philadelphia 76ers. A 2-2 split during the regular season, but Jason Tatum didn't play in any of these games. Paul George did not play in any of these games. We are currently awaiting the status of Joel Embiid. Is he going to be – I don't think he's going to be ready this weekend, but – do we see him like game three, game four? If it extends to seven, do we see him? Is he just out for the first round? We will see. So that obviously looms over the series. Within that, though, this very much feels like a wing series overall. When you have Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown on one side, on a basic level, I want to see how Paul George slots into this matchup and what it looks like in a playoff setting, because he has been very good for Philly since he's been back from the suspension. And like how they split the defensive duties between him and VJ Edgecombe, or even Kelly Oubre, if he's talking 2-4, is going to be interesting to me. Are you putting Paul George on Jason Tatum? Are you putting him on Jaylen Brown? Do you have VJ on Jaylen Brown? Is Kelly Oubre soaking that up so you can free up some of the offensive responsibility for the other two? Like, I'm curious about that portion. And then again, for Boston, they are proven they have won a championship. So I don't have major questions about like what they look like in a playoff series, but it's more so like who is going to set the tone first. Do you get Jason Tatum kind of flowing as a facilitator and then easing himself into the game as a scorer a little bit later while Jaylen Brown sets the tone? Does Jason Tatum try to set the tone with Jaylen Brown being that counterpunch? Oh, you got tired of Jason Tatum. Here come these drives. What are the order of operations there? How often are they used as screeners to kind of poke at Tyrese Maxey in particular? It's going to be interesting to me. And I think it's something that you brought up with our Eastern Conference Questions episode a week or so ago. With just, there is going to be an element of mismatch hunting with Jaylen Brown, with Jason Tatum trying to poke at Tyrese Maxey and some of the other smaller guards in Philly's rotation. How often do they go to that versus the flow that they naturally want to establish in the half court? Because this Sixers defense, they are a physical and active group, Steve. Very good showing against Orlando for whatever it's worth with where Orlando's offense is right now. I don't feel like complaining. But there is a higher ceiling to this Sixers defense on the perimeter that people may not be giving them credit for. So can Boston maintain their flow and have the wing slide into that is kind of where I start.
I think the intrigue of this series comes with how much can the Philadelphia 76ers sustain without Joel Embiid? And a lot of this is the theory that he is just out for the series, right? So how much can they sustain on both ends of the floor in this matchup? I think they are a confident bunch in the sense that we are led by our guard play. And this is where you give a credit and a tip of the cap to Nick Nurse to understanding how do I build something that doesn't need Joel Embiid to pop and can actually work. And so Tyrese Maxey being able to drive and kick, VJ Edgecombe being able to drive and kick, Paul George looking like he's an Indiana Pacer again to a degree as far as, yes, give me the ball to 17 feet. Let me face up. Let me post up. Let me attack. Okay, we have Kelly Oubre being aggressive. Like, we have elements of small ball. We have elements of being able to drive and kick. We have elements of being aggressive offensively. How does that play against a Boston defense that has multiple defenders who has the ability to shape, shift, and switch, who can work to keep the ball in front? So if you look at the Orlando game, Boston can do more of what Orlando tried to do defensively at a higher level. It's okay if we bother Tyrese Maxey, if we bother VJ, we bother Paul George, what are you getting? if we don't have to show help, are you creating enough baskets for yourself? Can we kind of contain what you want to do? Or on the flip side, Philadelphia, are you sticking too close to your base, Boston? And are you giving Tyrese Maxey too much room in pick and roll? And he can see a drop and get a pull up and get a feel going. Because, again, you go back to that playing game against Orlando. The Magic had Tyrese Maxey working his tail off to try and get any sort of basket, any sort of paint touch. And that was fine until the fourth quarter where Tyrese Maxey said, actually, I'm the type of player where that's fun, but I'm still going to be aggressive and make shots. And now that, oh no, he's done the thing we tried to take away. What do we do? That's the element of surprise there. So I think for Philly, they're going to have to be real. Nobody believes in us, real aggressive offensively, taking the shots they give. From Boston, how locked in are you to trying to take them away immediately? How much space are you giving these players immediately? Are you trying to get a feel for the game? Or are you trying to say, Tyrese, you cannot have this. BJ, you cannot have this. Paul George, you cannot have this. And so I think that's where it can get interesting over the course of a game one where, okay, what does Boston want to try versus a game one for Philly where it's like, we're not really supposed to be here to a degree. Let's roll the dice. Let's get out there and go. And so game one of this series becomes very interesting to me because I think Boston has the answers for what Philadelphia would try to provide in theory, as far as being able to poke at their best offensive players, their small. Will they tap those right away, or will they get into a scenario where we're feeling the game out, Philadelphia's aggressive, we're matchup hunting, we get a little slow, we're not making threes, and now we're in a scenario that we weren't expecting? Not that Boston is not aware and respects the game. They're built for these kind of fights. They've worked all season to be in these kind of fights. But can you catch them off guard? The issue I have, Nikias, before I swing the pill back to you.
Okay.
Do the Sixers have enough answers to win four of these is where my concern comes. Do I think they might be able to catch Boston at some point? Yes. Do I think Boston will be able to have more answers than Orlando did or anyone else could provide? Yes. That's where I think the matchup becomes tough because, okay, fine, we'll put Jason Tatum on a big, no more pick and roll for you guys. Yeah, we're aware that you're trying to attack and get in the paint. We're going to contain and contest and no more of that for you. So can Philadelphia put enough pressure on Boston offensively, and can Boston just have the answers from the outset and put their foot down in the series? That's the back and forth for me.
The tone setting seems very important for both sides here. And I think to kind of bounce off what you said, I actually want to hang on the Tyrese Maxey piece for a little bit. One, four regular season matchups against the Boston Celtics, averaged 30-9, shot well over 50% from three on nearly 9 attempts a game. That is insane. Converted 36% of his twos on 14 attempts. That is also insane. Derogatory. Your space point was the first thing I wanted to touch on among all the things that you said. I feel like that is top of mind for the Philadelphia 76ers in Boston here. Because tied to that is another question I have with Boston's bigs in general for talking about Philadelphia pathways. But for Tyrese Maxey in general, you are going to see a lot of Derek White, who's one of the best screen navigators that we have in the league. If it's not going to be him, I'm sure you're going to see some Hugo Gonzalez. You're going to see some Baylor Shireman at times. We'll see if Jordan Walsh gets some straight minutes as well. You are going to see a mix of ball pressure, navigation, and length that isn't necessarily new for him as the de facto number one option, but it is a heavy burden to wear. But Boston has been comfortable all year long. Nemeas Kata, we can creep you up to the level sometimes, but most of the time, let's have you deep in a drop. We will give you space to explore. That's where the pull-up shooting for Tyrese Maxey looms incredibly large. Not just the pull-up threes, in which it felt like he made all of them during the regular season series, but the pull-up twos as well. Can he mix in enough of the in-between stuff to make Boston think about creeping up? Because if he can, that opens up another avenue for the Sixers offense against this Boston defense. Because this is not a defense that wants to put two on the ball or wants to have their bigs at the level. Like, you've largely seen that with, you know, if we have Garza minutes at the five, we'll have him up at the level. And that's where you get some of the two on ball in Boston. If Maxey can take advantage of space enough, and if he can find more success inside the arc, because that's the kind of the hidden sauce for Boston, as you've talked about before this year, Steve, you may have the deep drop and feel like you have pull-up opportunities or drive opportunities. The second you get a foot inside the arc, you don't know when, where, and how much help is going to be shown. And then if you get through that with your gather, then it is Nemeas Kata contesting your shot at the rim on top of all of that. That nuance is something that Tyrese Maxey is going to have to navigate in real time. I think he is talented enough to do so, but he is going to have to be at A or A-plus level inside the arc to complement the pull-up chops that he has to give to the Sixers a higher floor and a higher ceiling. Because I think that sets the table for everything else. Again, Paul George, very strong to close out the regular season. Vijay Edgecombe, very strong to close out the regular season. Kelly Oubre, as we saw against Orlando, well, fine, I'll hit all these threes in the first quarter to give these other guys time to kind of ease into this game, because Tyrese Maxey didn't have fun through the first 2.5, 3 quarters of that game. So can you give yourself enough room? How they take advantage of that space is going to be key for me. Kind of flows to one of my X factors too, but I thought that was just a really good point to hit on, Steve. So I appreciate that coming from you.
No worries.
Other question I wanted to ask you, I guess for Philly, like how deep in the bench do you expect them to go in this series?
I mean, by default, don't they kind of have to? To a degree?
Like yes, with no Embiid. Like, obviously, some of the front court pieces are going to step up. You're going to see more Andre Drummond. We'll see how many corner threes he makes on top of that. We're going to see more Adembona. I guess more so in the guard room. Like, this has been such a high-minute season for Tyrese Maxey and such a high-minute season for Vijay Edgecombe. I just kind of wonder, you know, how often are we going to see those two plus Quentin Grimes at the three, Paul George at the four, et cetera? Like, can they get into smaller lineups? Does that feed into Boston's hands? Like, that's kind of where I'm going with that question.
It depends on how Philadelphia is able to attack and how they're able to defend and what that does. Like, because I think in theory, you could just see a high level of minutes for Maxey, Edgecombe, Paul George, insert big, plus fourth person. And so Barlow's been important for them. They've had different lineups where they're trying to do certain things, so we need a specific amount of energy or effort. But if it's a scenario where, hey, we got to lean into being able to score the basketball, I wouldn't be surprised if we see more Quentin Grimes and Kelly Oubre, and we're just, hey, we have these people on the court to try and get buckets, and we'll figure it out on the other end. And so I think it's more so, it's less about the amount of people that play and more about the, hey, can we get what we need on both ends? Can we have two-way lineups against the Boston Celtics, who have so many competitors and an identity that they know who they are and defend at a high level and also will continue to get the shots they want offensively? I think that's the question for Philly. Who are your X factors?
Okay. I think X factors for me, one quick point before I get into my X factors, keep an eye on the offensive rebounding in the series. I think that's going to be big. Assuming Embiid is out to begin this series, Andre Drummond, historically one of the best offensive rebounders that we have. Adembona, also a very good offensive rebounder. The Celtics, one of their quieter but important subplots this year, they were a very bad defensive rebounding team for the first month and a half of the year, ended up finishing as an elite one overall this season. So can the Sixers find any kind of edge creating extra possessions with their bigs, with Vijay Edgecombe or some of their wings crashing? That could give them a little bit more. They get them more bites at the apple. As far as my X factors go, Steve, I start with Kelly Oubre. Because again, defensively, is he going to take on one of the Jays? So one of Paul George, Vijay Edgecombe doesn't have to, or at least the bulk of it, because we're going to see it. But does he take one of those guys initially, and how does he do? He's going to be important to Philadelphia's transition attack. The three-point shooting is going to be very important in this series. I think you saw in that Orlando game, and you've seen throughout the regular season, teams are okay with letting Kelly Oubre shoot from the perimeter. Like, I don't know if we get as aggressive as the Celtics put Nemeas Kade on Kelly Oubre to keep him as a roamer. Like, I don't know if they tap that particular button, but there is a level of, we're fine if he's the end point of this possession, if we are keeping Tyrese Maxey out of the paint, if we are doubling, you know, healthy Joel Embiid in some of the matchups, whatever. Can he knock down enough shots? Can he mix in enough drives to make that, to feel that impact? And can he hold up well enough defensively? And then for the Celtics, Steve, Nikola Vucevic is kind of where I go. Because he is part of the deep drop contingent. He has played one game against the Sixers during the regular season series as a member of the Boston Celtics, to be clear. But his screening, pick and pop ability, the playmaking from the high post, that is a way to invert the offense for Boston and give them a different look. And with no Embiid, it feels a little bit more perilous, or at least in theory could be more perilous for that Sixers defense if Vooch is pulling their bigs out of the paint and opening up some of the cutting, some of the off-ball screening elsewhere, some of the handoffs. The offensive impact can be there defensively. And it's a broader question for the Sixers as well, because the Celtics are going to be in this deep drop. Can the Celtics defend well enough with Vooch in? In the one game that we saw with Vooch as a Celtic against the Sixers, 11 and 12 off the bench, you take that, went 3 of 6 from three. When defending in pick and roll, 1.09 points per possession, which is not a very good number. a lot of pull-ups, a lot of floaters in the film, a lot of fruitful shots missed on that front. And so for me, it's just like, which side of the coin do we land on? Is the offensive impact going to be strong and the defense holds up well enough? And that is just, those are minutes that the Sixers cannot deal with. Or does Vooch become someone that the Sixers can poke at to give them a little bit more room?
I did not have you picking Nikola Vucevic as your X factor on my bingo card, but you using that to take a "Hey, what's Vooch do?" shot is not surprising. So I'm trying to compose myself.
I don't know if that's what different that is. Degree. Come on.
We've done this podcast for 5 years. Long term dunkers, back me up. If you don't, it's fine. come on, you know what you did. It's fine. I take a deep breath. Zoom. Baylor Shireman for me. There are question marks about what the rotation looks like, but I do know Boston is willing to play a whole lot of people. They will figure out who they want to, and he's kind of just been a consistent force. Says, I will compete. I will make shots. You have to deal with me. I can guard different people. So I'm intrigued to see if he's able to elevate things for Boston in this series. For the Sixers, I'd probably go Quentin Grimes. As far as can he tap into the things that insert power forward did not think he could do, and can he have a high level of basketball play that now helps the Sixers have lineup versatility, have some more consistent offense? So that's where I'm intrigued.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. Who do you have in the series, good sir?
Celtics in six.
Okay, I have Celtics in five, especially if we're not going to get... Look, at the Embiid piece swings a good bit of this, because I do think if Embiid is available at any point of this series, like, I think there are legit upset chances here for the Sixers. Without Embiid, like, that chance shrinks a great deal for me. Not impossible, but it does lower. Boston is so well constructed, and if they don't get hit on the glass in particular and quickly on that front, 23.5 offensive rebound rate for the Sixers against the Celtics. That is their lowest against any opponent. And again, they have really good offensive rebounders in the room. They just have not been able to tap that button consistently against Boston so far. If they can't get that part either in this series, it just becomes a lot tougher. So I'm going Boston in five, but we are keeping an eye on the Embiid portion.
That's fantastic. I respect the possession battle, but offensive rebound rate. I respect the possession battle, but offensive rebound rate. Take us to a break.
That's a nice rhyme there, sir. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we do a little bit of previewing. We don't know what the 1-8 matchups are going to be yet. We're going to talk through what the potential matchups are going to be. So stick with us. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. Steve, let's talk through some play-in and some potential 1-8s. We have the Magic taking on the Hornets in the East. We have the Suns taking on the Warriors in the West. Winners of those matchups will face the Pistons and the Thunder, respectively. So we'll do like a little pseudo-preview here, Steve, as we have Magic Hornets kicking off the games later on tonight. If the Charlotte Hornets win this game and they are the matchup against the Detroit Pistons, funny enough, I kind of go to defense in this series. If this is the one that we get, the Charlotte Hornets over in the season, just outside the top 10 in defensive rating, which I think is a huge testament to how they were able to bounce back from what their start was. And in the calendar year 2026, they were just firmly a top 10 defense. And so for me, I wonder how much of that defense will travel in a postseason setting against this Detroit Pistons group. And for Detroit, are you able to keep this Charlotte flow-based offense in a box in any real capacity? Will your physicality override all of the flow and the three-point shooting that Charlotte can get to? Or does Charlotte get to run free a little bit? Like, I think the defenses are going to set the tone for this series pretty early if that's the one that we get. Yeah, and I think the fight night version, there is some legitimate smoke between these two, so I guess that is worth acknowledging. But yeah, like, there is a physicality difference between these two teams, which, again, the Detroit Pistons were just a top five defense all year long. The Hornets have been a top 10 defense for multiple months at this point, but they do go about it in different ways. It's active help. It's a lot of switching for Charlotte. The Pistons, in your own words, they'll just put their paws on you. And so I think how the games are refereed is going to be a quiet subplot of this one. How much of that physicality can Detroit establish, and what are the downstream effects of that? But I think that's going to be the fun. And like Jalen Duren versus Moussa Diabate, you have the antics that you'd be excited about. But in general, we talked about what the Jalen Duren face-up game has been like for Detroit and that growth there, and him just being able to take on more of that secondary scoring load. Moussa Diabate has shown in big picture matchups against star level bigs, I can hold my own in these matchups. If he is able to hold more of his own against Jalen Duren, especially as we flow into some of the non-Cade minutes, Charlotte has more of an avenue, because I do, in general, just trust their guard play overall more. Like, I think Cade is the best guard in this series overall, but I trust Charlotte's overall guard play more than I trust Detroit. So, like, if the big battle is more neutral, that's where the avenues get a little bit wider for the Hornets. So fascinated by that portion. Steve, if we get the Orlando Magic taking on the Detroit Pistons, what's your big picture thought? What are you excited about if that ends up being the 1-8 out East? Yeah. Yeah, I think for me, quickly on the regular season front, the Pistons swept the regular season matchups against the Hornets 3-0, tied 2-2 against the Orlando Magic. And the Magic are one of the teams, as inconsistent as they've been and as frustrated as I have been as a Magic believer this year, they can deal with Detroit's physicality, and they have a level of collective size that makes them pretty well equipped to deal with what Detroit wants to do with them. And on the flip side, if you talk about the Magic needing to hit a certain level defensively, they largely have during the regular season matchups, or at the very least they have in the half court. And as pretty much my only major question I have about the Pistons at this point is they've been pretty much wire to wire the best team in the East this year, at least standings wise. The half court offense has always been shaky to me. Their efficiency has been in the middle of the pack or worse, but they get away with it, quote unquote, because they have the lowest half-court frequency in basketball. Only 75% of their possessions were in the half-court, lowest one in the NBA. In the regular season matchups against Orlando, that went from 75 to nearly 78. Their half-court rating and their half-court offensive rating overall for the Pistons, 97.6, against the Orlando Magic, that dropped to 91.3. If the Orlando Magic are able to get the Detroit Pistons in the mud, this becomes a late-game shot-making fest, where you have Cade Cunningham on one hand, And obviously some of the three-point shooting from Duncan Robinson. You can get supplementary buckets elsewhere. Jalen Duren, we'll see what the face-up attacks look like. But him versus Wendell Carter Jr. could be fun. The Orlando Magic, if you get the version of Paolo that we've seen in his playoff runs, at the very least, hey, man, if Franz Wagner gives us a better showing than what we just saw in the play-in, because that was not good enough, and I don't think the Paolo performance was good enough either, there is some shot creation. There is some size there as well. And Desmond Bain, very quietly, has been one of the best clutch shot makers in the league this year, at least in terms of shots to tie or take the lead during clutch time. If they can get this close enough, like, it can get funny late in games. Like, I am fascinated by what this looks like. But to your point, the defense has to set the tone for the Orlando Magic. All right, let's flow to the West. We have Warriors Suns in the nightcap on Friday night. Electric win for the Golden State Warriors over the Los Angeles Clippers to end their season. Again, the Suns losing 114-110 to the Portland Trail Blazers. Just fun basketball games all around. Wanted to get that out there. But let's start with the Warriors. If they are able to beat the Suns and we get Thunder Warriors, we get Shea, we get Steph, we get Chet, we get Draymond. We have a lot of fun. But what are some of your big picture thoughts? What are some of your big picture questions if that is the series that we get, Steve? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's that time of year. No, I think that's fair. Like, both of these defenses, and I feel like that's kind of been a quiet subplot of the Warriors season because it's been so defined by Steph missed a bunch of games. Draymond missed some time. Jimmy Butler's out for the year. Is Jonathan Kuminga starting? Is he coming off the bench? Is he playing? Oh, no, he's been traded. Cool, we got Kristaps. Kristaps has missed some time. Is he playing? Their defense has done so many things this year. They have been a drop team. They have been an at-the-level team. They have been a flat-out trap team. They have been a zone team. They have been a downsize and switch everything team. They have been a traditional lineup and cross-match team. And I think being able to throw out that amount of looks in, one, the play-in setting against Phoenix, like, their offense is just going to have to be ready for all of that. And if they win that game, OKC, who I think still wins the series overall, hey, man, I don't know who Draymond's going to guard in that series. Do you just put him on Chet and say, you're not going to have a good time? Do you put him on Shea? Do you put him on Lou Dort and say, actually, I'm now just going to muck up everything Shea and Chet try to do when they get inside the arc? Like, there's a level of variance here that excites me. And obviously, Stephen Curry can just turn a game on its head at any moment, which was what made the win over the Clippers so electric. It's like, holy crap, where is this shot we can come from? He makes the deep three, falls into the crowd, didn't even know it went in. And then he starts celebrating and emoting. It's like, oh, this is the Steph Curry experience. This is fun. But I'm curious to see how OKC deals with both of these defenses, to your point. And even you know, related to the OKC offense overall, there are going to be a lot of small ball lineups played by either one of these teams, regardless of who wins this game. It's going to be Chet versus wings. It's going to be Jalen Williams versus switches. The big picture question for OKC, aside from health, and aside from, I guess, overall role player three-point shooting is, hey, what do you look like when you see smaller matchups? Can you win them consistently enough? For Jalen Williams, are these just going to be pull-up jumpers that he can make, of course, but are these going to be pull-up jumpers, or are you actually getting all the way to the rim? For Chet Holmgren, are these going to be turnaround jumpers, which he can make, or are you getting all the way to the rim? Are you getting busy on the offensive glass in some of these setups? So, like, I think good, you know, similar to what we said with San Antonio, I think either one of these series are going to be very good first-round tests for OKC, with some of the quiet areas that have been a little bit more inconsistent for them this year. But overall, like, I do think the Thunder are advancing regardless of if the Suns or the Warriors get through in this play-in matchup. But I'm excited to see what that part is going to look like. And that concludes the playoff / play-in preview. We'll get confirmed results later tonight. Playoffs are starting this weekend. You want to make sure you're rocking with us. The playoff coverage is going to be unrivaled, and even in the short term. Stick with us because we're going to take a break right here. When we return, shifting to the W side, more free agency movement, rosters are getting finalized. We are getting closer to training camp and ultimately preseason games. So we're going to go over some winners and losers as well. We'll be right back. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. Let's shift to the W, Steve. Some more free agent nuggets are coming through over the last few days as teams are getting closer to filling their training camp rosters and things. Training camp just starting over the weekend. A lot of emails that have been sent out. Like, we're kicking things off on Sunday. I think the following Sunday, we're going to get some preseason games. Like, we are right around the corner of the W regular season, Steve. It's almost preview time. It's going to be fun. Let's talk through some of the recent news nuggets. We start with the Las Vegas Aces, Steve, who won. Congratulations to Asia Wilson for signing a 3-year deal at Supermax. $1.4 million this year, and then whatever the 20% of cap number is going to be for the next 2 years. Salute to her. Best player in the league, already on the fast track to becoming the greatest WNBA player of all time. A no-brainer for the Aces to pull this off. So I wanted to give the quick salute there. I'd argue, though, while this is the biggest and most important news, the most interesting news to come through the Aces pipeline this week was them signing Kennedy Carter, who we did not see last season. In 2024, was very good with Chicago Sky, one of the most electric drivers and interior scorers that we have in the guard spot. And the Aces have added Kennedy Carter to the mix. And I am fascinated by the talent swing here. And I think this even extends to the draft. We didn't get much into what the Aces did in the draft on Tuesday, but even them taking the flyer on Janiyah Barker at 29 felt like a slight departure from generally we want someone that does X. We want Aaliyah Nye because she can shoot. You want to go back. We want Asia Shepherd because she can shoot. We want insert player here because they can defend. Janiyah Barker is very much, you are 6'3", 6'4", very skilled. You have not been able to put it together yet. We feel like we can get you in our ecosystem, whether she ends up signing the last contract spot available or she gets one of the developmental spots. But we believe we can mold you and you can become whatever the best version of yourself is. I'm intrigued by kind of a slight shift in philosophy. It feels like from the outside, from the Aces. And I think Kennedy Carter also slots into that. It's less, can you fit around our stars, and more, you are incredibly good. You can also solve something for us we can get into. But I'm just fascinated by how the Aces offseason has ultimately ended as they build out this roster. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I think that's the most impressive part of all of this. There were absolutely aspects where it's like, hey, I see the theory behind this. This is not really working the way that it needs to be, to the point where the Las Vegas Aces were under 500. And then they win 16 straight, and then they ultimately win the championship. They found it at the right time. And like, this is a similar point that I've been having, or similar conversation I've been having elsewhere. In the early stages of free agency, it's like, well, the Aces haven't done anything but brought their own people back heading into this week. And I'm just like, I am also a little, not frustrated, but I also have my brow raised. Like, there are some interesting vets out there that I feel like would have fit. But I would imagine the internal bet is we are another year removed from, like, the Chelsea injury stuff. Jackie isn't coming in banged up with the role kind of in flux. There's just a level of health that they're coming into this training camp and hopefully preseason and hopefully regular season that they didn't last year. And to your point, Steve, just the overall continuity should be better. And so if the start of the year, you get a better version of Chelsea Gray and a better version of Jackie Young and everything else stays the same, the Aces should not have the start that they had last year. If you get better from those two, plus Jewel Lloyd because of continuity, plus Nalissa Smith because of continuity, and then you're adding Kennedy Carter into the mix on top of that, that's where you're really cooking. And as the league still looks relatively different in light of what this free agency period was, the Aces are like, well, yeah, we're bringing back like 8 of our 10 and we're adding these pieces. Like, there's a level of continuity that we have that I think, you know, we're going to get into free agency winners and losers. I think the Liberty are a big winner for this free agency period. We're entering this offseason with a level of continuity that even the Liberty don't have in terms of like who's coming in, who's coming out. We may be able to start the season 10-3 without hitting full blast yet, because we just have our people in the building. And then you have the talent added, Kennedy Carter, and things like that. I think, while we're on the Aces, I did want to ask, in general, like the Kennedy fit on both ends and how she slots into the different lineups that the Aces can play is something that I'm intrigued by. I have my quibbles about like some spacing things. If it is like her plus Asia plus Nalissa on the floor together, I think teams are going to be comfortable like showing help in the paint. It's something that Asia has seen plenty of, etc. Kennedy being one of the best like short area scorers in the league on top of that makes that easier to deal with. But one of the subplots for the Aces last year as they were trying to figure things out was Asia Wilson, once again, one of, if not the most double team player in the league, that cramped spacing, put more emphasis on three-point shooting, yada, yada, yada. So like, how do you feel Kennedy slots into that? And then going from the lineup portion, like what do you think is going to be the best uses there? Do you see her in, you know, three guard looks? Does she eventually start for this Aces group? Like, how do you kind of see that fit? Need you, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's fair. And I was just kind of thinking through, I ended up tweeting a thread about it, but like potential lineups we're going to see when the Aces split up their core four and what those lines can look like. And I agree with you. I think we are going to see just in general a lot of three guard looks for the Aces, or two guards plus Chelsea. You are now the nominal four type beat. So it's still three guards in a sense. The starting lineup is going to be interesting. And this is where I'm. Oh, go ahead. Let me start that over there. And so I think looking at the starting lineup, I'm curious to see where they go. And this is where I'm excited to see like what training camp is going to be. I want to get on these Zooms, maybe even go to Vegas to see some of the early returns there and see how they want to start. Like, do we, if you're the Aces, is Jewel Lloyd coming off the bench? Like, I asked her in her exit interview, like, how much does starting matter to you? And she said, like, honestly, it doesn't really matter all that much to me at this point. Like, I'm in a place in my life, to paraphrase at this point, I'm in a place in my life, like, I just kind of want to have my joy playing basketball, and I'll do whatever the team asks me to do. Like, I'll start if they ask me, but I'm not pressing about it. And so if it is actually Kennedy plus Jewel, Dana Evans also back, so those three off the bench, a starting lineup, if you go Chelsea, Jackie Young, Kirsten Bell is kind of like your low maintenance fifth starter. Melissa Smith, Asia Wilson, that's a good bit of size, 3-5. Jackie at the two, I feel like, is just a different beast. And obviously, Chelsea can just post up smaller guards, et cetera. That gives you a fairly strong starting point that you could then flow into. Here comes Jewel Lloyd in the shooting. Here comes Dana Evans in the ball pressure, some of the drives. Here comes Kennedy Carter in all of the drives and the shot creation that we both talked about at this point. They have a lot of different avenues. Like, I'm curious about just the overall size in the perimeter room. And I think that becomes more pressing as you get into like potential matchups with Liberty and stuff like that. But this is a talented group. And for them to end free agency with that kind of talent swing is pretty impressive, I must say. And as you've already alluded to, the locker room is strong. The staff is strong. If you're talking about insulating things, it should work from that perspective. I have my questions defensively with that group. I do not doubt that we are going to see it at some point. Am I personally ready for it? I need to see how that group is going to defend. I think I'll leave it there. This is why you're already chuckling. You know my you know my basketball sensibility. You know my basketball sensibilities. You know what? As we talked about the New York Liberty, we got a little bit of news on that front. Nothing super new, but we have the contract terms for Satu Sabally at the very least. 2 years, nearly $1.7 million. That is a hefty pay cut. And I think if that is the Satu contract, which super interesting to me, that this is a 2-year deal at this and not a 1 year at 800 something thousand, whatever. It's like, hey, what does that portend for when we eventually get the Breanna Stewart terms, the Jonquel Jones terms, Sabrina Ionescu, who has the core designation? And I think that has to be accepted. We're recording on a Friday morning. That has to be accepted or that is going away. So I'm curious to see like what those contracts are going to be. And ultimately, if you're bringing Satu in, there's already an understanding like, Sabrina, you're not making 1.4 if we're doing this. But is that just going to be the bit? Is it Satu at 8 and then everyone else is hovering around 950 or something like that? Like, that part is interesting to me. And then the other piece is Vinay Jelani Hamilton, suspended contract, right? So nobody else could negotiate with Vinay Jelani Hamilton unless the Liberty renounced those rights. They did not do that. She is back. And ooh boy, from a personal standpoint, just seems like one of the best people in the W. But when you also factor in the shooting, the random post-ups, the defense is insane. Oh boy, can the Liberty throw out some fun lineups. So I wanted to give the quick salute there. Did you have any Banaja / Satu thoughts you wanted to add on the Liberty front? Whoo! Mm-hmm. As will opposing offenses, but we'll leave that there. Can I drop a stat for you, Steve? So I just wanted to quickly get as you were talking through some of the defensive potential. So going back to 2024, because we didn't see Banaja last year. Regular season plus playoffs. We got 351 minutes of Breonna Stewart, Banaja Laney-Hamilton, Leoni Fevers, and Jonquil Jones on the floor together. A plus 16.5 net rating in those minutes. A 96.5 defensive rating in those minutes. Opponents converted 48.7% of their twos in those minutes. And now your fifth can be Sabrina, which lowers the defensive ceiling, though she has grown to be a solid defender. But you boost the offense. Or if you really just want to size up and now you're adding Satu to that, that's even more size that you could toss in with those four. What do you do against that group? Like, I think in, for the purposes of this, you were thinking through the Liberty are up to 14 seconds left. The other team's called a timeout. They have to tie or try to take the lead. And now your five-player grouping is Stewie, Banaja, Leoni, Jonquil, and Satu, however you want to line it up, 1-5. And they can just switch everything, and you're not going to have fun. Good gracious. That's such a great – that is good work for the New York Liberty. So, again, over the weekend, I'm sure we're going to get the actual contract terms for the other three as we get closer to training camp, but – oh boy, that is very well done. Other news nuggets. The Toronto Tempo getting busy. They signed Kia Nurse. Shout out Chelsea Late for breaking that one, by the way, shortly after the draft concluded on Monday night. Got the late bomb that the Tempo would be signing Kia Nurse, and that has since happened. And Timmy Fagbenle, someone that I've been keeping an eye on throughout this free agency cycle, was very good for the Golden State Valkyries last season, particularly on the defensive end. And I was like, huh, she's still on the market. Surely the Valkyrie's going to bring her back for her importance and things. The Tempo earlier in the cycle sent a max offer sheet to Shakira Austin in Washington. The Mystics matched that. It was like, no, we still want to add a versatile big that can boost our defense and can rim run and transition and things and can screen for our guards. 1 year, $1 million for Timmy Fagbenle. So salute for getting that kind of payday based off of the year that she had last year, which was a very good one. How do you feel about the Timmy fit in Toronto? And as they've kind of rounded out their roster at this point, like, where are you at with the Tempo roster so far? No, I think that's fair. I think I'm curious to see like how they round out the starting lineup. And again, training camp is about to start. We're going to get preseason games, et cetera. So we'll get those answers over the next few weeks. But are you starting Brittany Sykes and Marina Mabry just as your backcourt? Are you slotting them as your 2 and 3 and you're starting Julie Alamon? Are you just immediately starting Kiki Rice and having Alamon as kind of your veteran point guard to kind of cycle in if necessary? Are you starting Timmy and the Arsabli together? Are you starting Timmy at the 5 and then going short, you know, slightly smaller, spacier at the 4? get a Katia Laksa maybe as like your spot starter at the four, just so you could have that volume 3-point shooting out there. Like, I'm curious to see how Sandy Brundello puts this piece together. But I couldn't be happier for Timmy, though. I don't think it is said enough or has been said enough just how good she was for Golden State and the many things that they executed defensively under Natalie Nicasse last season was the elite defense pretty much from day one. Surprisingly so, as they made the playoffs. But Timmy was a big part of that. Get you at the level, late switches, can mix that in. She's just incredibly good. And for whatever stops they are able to generate with this group, she is going to run as fast as she can down the middle of the floor. And you're going to have to account for that. And then they open up some looks there. So really love the signing there. Other news, the Dallas Wings, Alicia Clark, Odyssey Sim headlined a bunch of training camp deals that were offered. And so it feels like they're bringing in like 35 people into camp. I know it is not literally doing that, but on the vet front, Alicia Clark is in there. Odyssey Sims also in there. And then the other news that we got late last night via Christina Williams, the Mercury and Kalani Brown agreeing to a contract buyout. And so I think she was on the minimum that got scaled up. And she was already under contract, but now a contract buyout. So we'll see ultimately where she ends up landing. But with the Dallas Wings, Steve, I am fascinated by this group. There has been a lot of conversation around this group as they, you know, drafted AZ Foot at number one. Round up the draft from there. We've had all sorts of conversations around press conferences and all the things. And we have vets in the room and a lot of young players already on the roster. I am fascinated to see how Jose Fernandez is able to shape and put this together. As Alicia Clark and Odyssey Sims are on training camp deals, unprotected deals, baseline level one, will they make the roster? Two, if they do, I do think there are interesting fits here for both of them. One, on a basic level, I am just glad Odyssey Sims has been signed before like July, because it feels like five or six, it feels like 3 years in a row where it's like Odyssey Sims on a free agent market, Odyssey Sims gets an emergency contract of some sort, Odyssey Sims plays well, they sign her for the rest of the season, and then we end up a free agency period, and it's like, wait, why has no one signed Odyssey Sims? So hopefully she does make the roster. I think the drive still hit and still get after it defensively, and they'll cross match her in different ways as well. At least they did so with the Sparks. That's going to be fun. The Alicia Clark fit is an interesting one for me. The veteran know-how kind of speaks for itself, but someone that can still knock down shots from the perimeter, though did not do so at a high clip last season, but we do have the history there. I'm curious to see if they view AC as more of a 3 or a 4 with this roster construct. And I think that's where I want to toss the ball to you, just kind of where you're at with this Dallas roster now that we have so many pieces in, but it does feel like a whole lot of guards, a whole lot of bigs. The wing room feels a little bit more open. Does that raise the brow for you at all? Or I think the attempt is, I was going to say admirable, but that was going to sound shady, and I don't want to be shady at all. Like, I think building a roster out and having this level of perceived versatility, I think is smart. And I think if you want to go bigger picture with the league, I think we are just going that way. I think we're going to lean more into skilled size and like lineup versatility behind that, but skilled size is going to win the day. This is where the Liberty offseason becomes even more interesting. It's like we have so many really good players that are like 6'3 or taller, not just high level talents, but we're also just massive and can shrink the floor. And so Dallas trying to get into elements of that is interesting to me. I am really curious about the defensive piece of all of this. Because I think offensively, it is easy to see if there's a line of construction where you mentioned like three bigs and Matty Seegers is your nominal three. Oh, Matty Seegers is putting people underneath the basket and or just getting to the mid-range shots. And whoever's defending her is going to be at a disadvantage. You're not going to have a good time. Defensively, do I want Matty defending threes? Like, probably not. You know what I mean? And even to your core three at this point in Paige Bueckers, Arike Ogunbowale, AZ Foote, and this is something that I want to ask or did ultimately ask Jose Fernandez about. It's like, what do you see the fit being with those three defensively? Because they don't fall into the size element of this. This is more of the skill element of this. How do you see them gelling defensively? Is this going to be, AZ, you are taking on tougher on-ball assignments than anticipated. Paige, you are on wings. Arike, you are on like non-shooter, non-on-ball threat to conserve you. Is Paige taking on more of the tougher on-ball duties? Is Arike kind of reframing her game and taking on some of those on-ball duties? Like, we've seen her in different spots last year, like Kelsey Mitchell in different spots last year for Fever, if you want to comp to where, like, are you the number one perimeter defender on our team or on our roster? No. Are you willing to take on this number one assignment for a quarter, et cetera? Yes, I am. Like, is Arike going to be tapping into that bag more this year? Independent of if it works or not, I am curious about, like, what the attempts are going to be. And I'm just ready to see what that's going to look like. Which, So yeah, Cody boy. It's been a long time since I feel good about a Dallas Wings defense. With that framing, the bar is very low. We are a year plus removed now from the Wings being percentage points away from having the worst defensive rating in W history, and their defense last year was not at that level but was still bad. And as I talked to you about on this very podcast and wrote in other places, hey man, y'all don't have the personnel to be putting two on the ball the way that y'all are. Y'all need to stop this. Why am I seeing two on the ball against Courtney Vandersloot? Like, cut this out, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think it is fair for you to bring up and smart to bring up that, like, structurally, this is going to look different. The front court talent is certainly higher than what it was last year, particularly on the defensive end. And so the floor for the defense is going to be higher. I think within that framing, how much better is Dallas's defense going to be compared to last year? I think there's going to be a sizable bump. Taking the extra step or just kind of broadening the scope to where are the Wings going to be compared to everyone else is where my bigger questions come in. If you're looking at a team that I would imagine they want to get into the playoff picture this year with the moves they make, like, I don't think you spend $2+ million on your front court and select AZ Foote who I think had the highest floor of the top four picks, but may not have had the highest ceiling of the top four picks. I don't think you make that pick if you're not ready to compete more immediately, if that makes sense. And so through that lens, I'm just like, okay, I want to see it. I agree with you that, like, no, it is not the defense to defense is not a series of 105 one-on-ones. That is a deep cut for some very specific listeners. So that is not what defense is. But I am curious to see, like, how the jobs are going to be delineated 1 through 3. I think there is going to be a level of switching, to your point. But how they start, like, that is, we talk about this every time the playoffs roll around for either league. I am always fascinated by, like, who's getting the first crack at star player X and things like that. And so I am curious. They're going to be switching. So this is. Okay, fair enough. A lot of, we have way more time to talk about the Dallas Wings. Can we get into some free agency winners and losers as teams are again heading into training camp? We're seeing more. Okay, so I start on the winner side. The New York Liberty, because duh. You brought back your core three. You added Satu Sabli to this. You brought back Benaj Laney Hamilton. You're able to add Rebecca Allen as wing depth, and you did so on an unprotected contract from the front office side, which is very well done. The Liberty are pretty easy for me. The Atlanta Dream, also pretty easy winners for me. You brought back your entire core, and I think literally everyone took some version of a pay cut among the core that was re-signed. Alicia Gray got the max, did not get the super max when she could have, and would have been justified doing so. Ryan Howard could have got a full-blown max, took a little bit of a haircut. Bree Jones took a little bit of a haircut. Nas Hillman, in a world in which Shakira Austin got a max contract offer, surely someone could have threw out $950 a year for Nas Hillman. She takes a little over $8. You bring her back. You trade for Angel Reese without giving up anything of consequence in terms of the actual players on the roster. The Atlanta Dream are pretty easy winners for me in this free agency period. Tyler Marsh, head coach of the Chicago Sky. I could just put the Sky here, but I think Tyler Marsh in particular, getting a roster that he is excited about and listening to him in his introductory presser with a lot of the free agent acquisitions and draft acquisitions, he just sounds so much lighter and very excited about what he's going to be able to do with this Sky group and the level of versatility that they have in the room. Now, as we get closer to the regular season and preview stuff or whatever, we can dig into potential questions with the Sky roster. But he just seems to be in a better spot. And the Sky roster has obviously added a lot of talent in this cycle. So happy for Tyler Marsh. The Asia Wilson one is an easy one. When you get the biggest contract in W history, that's a yes. And I want to give a quick salute to close out the winter section for me. Brittany Griner just getting a regular max on 1 year based on the season that was last season. It is a salute to her and ultimately just what she has meant to the W overall. But it's a big salute to her. And to broaden the scope, because I didn't get to say this on Tuesday, I really like the Connecticut Sun and what they did during the draft. I feel like they absolutely nailed it in terms of upside swings, in terms of, hey, let's add some more shooting in the room. There's like a nice upside plus fit blend that I thought they nailed that I have to apologize for not getting to on Tuesday, as we talked about the Storm, you know, trading for Flage and getting our fam and some of the other moves in the lottery. The Connecticut Sun did one heck of a good job, and I am excited to see what that group is going to look like. A full year of Layla Lacan, Sadia Rivers defending, BG, I guess, is the Tina Charles replacement, which I guess also just kind of what is happening with Tina Charles. Is she playing in the W this upcoming season? If so, where is she landing? Like, I'm curious about that part. Also, where is Natasha Cloud landing? Is something that I'm very curious about. I can't believe we are this late into the cycle. We don't have a signing there. But those are my winners, Steve. Anyone you want to add or anything you disagree with in that section? Aww. Yeah. Yeah. You know what? Fair enough. As I get to some of my offseason losers to close this thing out, I have the Washington Mystics here. And I think, not a shocker, because I do think if you fire your GM and part of your offseason plan is, end quote from the ESPN piece, we want to add higher level proven talent. And the only person that you have signed is Mikaela Onyewere, who is good. but it's not like an all-star caliber needle mover. I don't think you accomplished your goal if that is what your goal was. And for as much as I like Lauren Betts being there and what that front court can look like, there is just a lack of shooting on the roster that might make things more difficult for some of the developmental pieces that you added in the groove, in addition to what you already have. And so, like, that is where I'm just like, I want to see how Washington builds this thing out, because they have so many young pieces that I like on the roster. I think Sidney Johnson did a tremendous job with the Mystics last season. And so I trust him in general, but like, you do just need more shooting on your roster. You want more space for Kiki Ariyafin. You want more space for Shakira Austin. You want more space for Lauren Betts. You want more space for Sonya Citron. Like, she can't just be the spacing, especially if you want to explore more of what she wants to do on the ball, like we saw in the second half of last season. I want them to have more room to operate in a literal sense. And so they land here. In a literal sense, Natasha Cloud lands here because she is still a free agent. And like, part of adding Satu Sabli and some of these other pieces and bringing the core back is that she seems to be on the outside looking in, which is just kind of unfortunate for her. And so, again, I am curious to see where she lands, because she's still a very good player. And then the last thing I wanted to add, Steve, is just players that had reserved rights, which, if you are more in the NBA space, not familiar with the W space, just reserved player rights, it is exclusive negotiating power. It's like a more restrictive version of restricted free agency, which is where you get Ray Burrell training camp contract is on the minimum. This is where you get Monique Okoro-Makani a slight bump above the minimum in year one, but then it drops down to the minimum in year two, where I think Maya Caldwell, similar training camp deal, to where if they were on the open market or were open to like restricted free agency offers where people could send out an offer sheet and then you get the match, I think they just cash out in a bigger way than they were able to because of those rights. So like, I'm not a big fan of the concept. That is going to be the conceptual / CBA thing that I start railing against over the next few years, similar to what I do with like restricted free agency and the draft on the NBA side. I think reserved player rights is going to be the thing for me, but that is where I land, Steve. Anything you disagree with or want to add before we get out of here? Okay, I have disappointed Steve. Hopefully I did not disappoint any of you. Thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We're on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports main YouTube channel if you haven't already. That's where a lot of our WNBA content is going. So if you want to watch along on that front, that is where you can find it. You can follow me on socials at NakaisNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, happy play-in closing season, happy playoff season, and we will catch y'all next week.